comes booming toward us from the backyard, where he's grilling 35 pounds of meat, even though it's January, not July. His T-shirt says, "Suck it, Senators." 12 years ago, he was a professional hockey player better known as the Slammer, until he shattered his femur against another player's head. He looks the same as he did the last time I saw him. Too handsome and too fit for a guy his age, like he expects to be called back to duty at any moment. But his dark hair is flecked with gray, which is new. He hugs my sisters and slaps me on the back. Unlike most hockey players, he somehow managed to keep his teeth, and he flashes them at us now like we're groupies. He wants to know how our week was, how was school, did we learn anything he might not know. This is a challenge, his equivalent of throwing down the gauntlet. It's a way for us to try to stump wise old Pops, which is no fun for anyone, and so we all say no. Dad asks about the November-December study away program, and it takes me a minute to realize he's talking to me.
It was okay.
Good one, Kate. I make a note to thank her. He doesn't know about the shutting down or the trouble at school beyond sophomore year, because last year, after the guitar-smashing episode, I told Principal Wirtz my dad was killed in a hunting accident. He never bothered to check up on it, and now he calls my mother whenever there's a problem, which means he actually calls Kate because Mom never bothers to check voicemail. I pick a leaf off the grill. They invited me to stay on, but I turned them down. I mean, as much as I enjoy figure skating, and as good as I am at it, I guess I get that from you, I'm not sure I want to make a career of it. One of the great pleasures of my life is making comments like this, because having a gay son is my bigoted prick of a father's worst nightmare. His only response is to pop open another beer and attack the 35 pounds of meat with his tongs like it's in danger of rising up and devouring us all. I wish it would. When it's actually time to eat, we sit in the white and gold dining room with the natural wool carpet, the most expensive money can buy. This is apparently a huge improvement over the shitty nylon carpet that was in the house when they moved in. Josh Raymond barely clears the table, because his mother is small and her ex-husband is small, unlike my dad, who is a giant. My stepbrother is a different sort of small than I was at his age. The neat and tidy sort. No elbows or ears jutting out, everything in proportion. This is one thing that leads me to believe he may not be genetically linked to my father after all. Right now, Josh Raymond kicks at the table leg and stares at us over his plate with the enormous, unblinking eyes of an owl. I say, "How's it hanging, little man?" He squeaks a reply, and my father, the Slammer, strokes his perfectly stubbled jaw and says in the soft, patient voice of a nun, "Josh Raymond, we've discussed kicking the table." It is a tone he has never once used with me or my sisters. Decca, who has already filled her plate, begins eating as Rose Marie serves everyone else one by one. When she gets to me, I say, "I'm good without, unless you've got a veggie burger on there." She only blinks at me, her hand still hovering in midair. Without turning her face, she swivels her eyes in my father's direction.
"Veggie burger?"
His voice isn't soft or patient.
"I was raised on meat and potatoes, and I've made it to 35.
He was 43 in October.
"I figured my parents were the ones putting the food on the table, so it wasn't my job to question it."
He pulls up his shirt and pats his stomach, still flat but no longer a six-pack, shakes his head and smiles at me, the smile of a man who has a new wife and a new son and a new house and two new cars, and who only has to put up with his old, original kids for another hour or two.
I don't eat red meat, Dad.
Actually, to be technical, it's 80s Finch who's the vegetarian.
Since when?
Since last week.
Oh, for Christ's.
Dad sits back and stares at me as Decca takes a big, bloody bite of her burger, the juice dripping down her chin.
Kate says, "Don't be an asshole, Dad. He doesn't have to eat it if he doesn't want to."
Before I can stop him, 80s Finch says, "There are different ways to die. There's jumping off a roof, and there's slowly poisoning yourself with the flesh of another every single day."
"I'm so sorry, Theo. I didn't know."
Rosemarie darts a look at my father, who's still staring at me.
"How about I make you a potato salad sandwich?"
She sounds so hopeful that I let her, even though the potato salad has bacon in it.
"He can't eat that. The potato salad has bacon."
This is from Kate.
My dad says, "Well, he can goddamn pick it out."
The "out" sounds like "oot," a relic of Dad's Canadian upbringing. He's starting to get annoyed, and so we shut up, because the faster we eat, the faster we leave. At home, I give Mom a kiss on the cheek, because she needs it, and I inhale the scent of red wine.
"Did you kids have fun?"
she asks, and we know she's hoping we'll beg for permission to never go there again.
Decca says, "We most certainly did not,"
and goes stomping up the stairs. My mother sighs in relief before taking another drink and going after her. She does her best parenting on Sundays. Kate opens a bag of chips and says, "This is so stupid." And I know what she means. This equals our parents and Sundays, and maybe our whole screwed up lives.
"I don't even see why we have to go over there and pretend to like each other when everyone knows that's exactly what we're doing. Pretending."
She hands me the bag. "Because people like you to pretend, Kate. They prefer it." She flicks her hair over her shoulder and scrunches up her face in a way that means she's thinking.
"You know, I've decided to go to college in the fall after all."
Kate offered to stay home when the divorce happened. "Someone needs to look after Mom," she said. Suddenly, I'm hungry, and the two of us pass the bag back and forth, back and forth. I say, "I thought you liked having time off from school." I love her enough to pretend along with her that this is the other reason she stayed home, that it had nothing to do with her cheating high school boyfriend, the same one she'd planned her future around. She shrugs.
"I don't know. Maybe it's not quite as time off as I expected. I'm thinking about going to Denver, maybe seeing what's to see out there."
"Like Logan?"
Better known as the cheating high school boyfriend.
"This has nothing to do with him."
"I hope not."
I want to repeat the things I've been telling her for months. "You're better than him. You've already wasted too much time on that asshole." But her jaw has gone rigid, and she is frowning into the chips bag.
"It beats living at home."
I can't argue with her there, so instead I ask, "Do you remember Eleanor Markey?"
"Sure, she was in my class. Why?"
"She's got a sister.
I met her on the bell tower when we were both thinking about jumping. We could have held hands and leaped off together. They would have thought we were star-crossed lovers. They'd write songs about us. We'd be legends."
Kate shrugs.
"Eleanor was okay. A little full of herself. She could be fun. I didn't know her all that well. I don't remember her sister."
She finishes the wine from Mom's glass
and grabs the car keys. Later. Upstairs, I bypass Split Ends, Depeche Mode, and the Talking Heads for Johnny Cash. I throw at Folsom Prison onto the turntable, fish through my desk for a cigarette, and tell 80s Finch to get over it. After all, I created him, and I can take him away. As I light the cigarette, though, I can suddenly picture my lungs turning as black as a newly paved road, and I think of what I said to my dad earlier. There are different ways to die. There's jumping off a roof, and they're slowly poisoning yourself with the flesh of another every single day. No animals died to make this cigarette, but for once, I don't like the way it makes me feel, like I'm being polluted, like I'm being poisoned. I stub it out, and, before I can change my mind, break all the others in half. Then I cut the halves with scissors and sweep them into the trash, sign on to the computer, and start typing. January 11th. According to the New York Times, nearly 20% of suicides are committed by poison, but among doctors who kill themselves, that number is 57%. My thoughts on the method seems like kind of a coward's way out, if you ask me. I think I'd rather feel something. That said, if someone held a gun to my head, ha-ha, sorry, suicide humor, and made me use poison, I'd choose cyanide. In gaseous form, death can be instant, which I realize defeats the purpose of feeling something. But, come to think of it, after a lifetime of feeling too much, maybe there's actually something to be said for fast and sudden. When I finish, I walk into the bathroom to dig through the medicine cabinet. Advil, aspirin, some kind of over-the-counter sleeping pills I stole from Kate and then stored in an old prescription bottle of Mom's. I meant what I said to Embryo about drugs. We don't mix. What it comes down to for me is I have a hard enough time keeping control over my brain without something else getting in the way. But you never know when you might need a good sleeping pill. I open the bottle now, dump the blue tablets into my palm, and count them. 30. Back at my desk, I line the pills up one by one, like a little blue army. I sign on to Facebook, and over on Violet's page, someone from school has posted about her being a hero for saving me. There are 146 comments and 289 likes, and while I'd like to think there are this many people grateful that I'm still alive, I know better. I go to my own page, which is empty, except for Violet's friend picture. I set my fingers on the keyboard, looking at the way they rest there, the nails, broad and round. I run my hands along the keys, as if I'm playing piano. And then I type, "Obligatory family meals suck, especially when meat and denial are involved. I feel we can't go through another of those terrible times, especially when there is so much else to do." The quote is from Virginia Woolf's suicide note to her husband, but I think it fits the occasion. I send the message and wait around the computer, organizing the pills into groups of 3, then 10, when really I'm hoping for something from Violet. I work at banging the license plate flat again, scribble down "another of those terrible times," and add it to the wall of my room, which is already covered in notes just like this. The wall has various names: wall of thoughts, wall of ideas, wall of my mind, or just the wall, not to be confused with Pink Floyd. The wall is a place to keep track of thoughts as fast as they come, and remember them when they go away. Anything interesting or weird or even halfway inspired goes up there.
An hour later, I check my Facebook page. Violet has written, "Arrange whatever pieces come your way." My skin starts to burn. She's quoting Virginia Woolf back to me. My pulse has tripled its pace. Shit, I think. That's all the Virginia Woolf I know. I do a quick internet search, looking for just the right response. Suddenly I wish I'd paid more attention to Virginia Woolf, a writer I've never had much use for until now. Suddenly I wish I'd done nothing but study her for all of my 17 years. I type back, "My own brain is to me the most unaccountable of machinery, always buzzing, humming, soaring, roaring, diving, and then buried in mud. And why? What's this passion for?" This goes to what Violet said about time filler, and how none of it matters, but it's also me exactly. Buzzing, humming, soaring, roaring, diving, and then falling deep into mud. So deep, I can't breathe. The asleeps and awakes, no in-betweens. It's a damn good quote, so good it gives me chills. I study the hairs standing up on my arm, and by the time I look back at the screen, Violet has responded, "When you consider things like the stars, our affairs don't seem to matter very much, do they?" I'm full on cheating now, pulling up every Virginia Woolf site I can find. I wonder if she's cheating too. I write, "I am rooted, but I flow." I nearly change my mind. I think about deleting the line, but then she writes back, "I like that one. Where is it from?" The waves. I cheat again and find the passage. Here's more. "I feel 1,000 capacities spring up in me. I am arch, gay, languid, melancholy by turns. I am rooted, but I flow. All gold, flowing." I decide to end there, mostly because I'm in a hurry to see if she'll write back. It takes her 3 minutes. "I like, this is the most exciting moment I have ever known. I flutter, I ripple, I stream like a plant in the river, flowing this way, flowing that way, but rooted, so that he may come to me. Come, I say, come." My pulse isn't the only part of my body stirring now. I adjust myself and think how weirdly, stupidly sexy this is. I write, "You make me feel gold, flowing." I post it without thinking. I can go on quoting Virginia Woolf. Believe me, the passage gets even hotter, but I decide I want to quote myself instead. I wait for her response. I wait for 3 minutes. 5 minutes, 10, 15. I open up her website, the one she ran with her sister, and check the date of the last post, which hasn't changed since the last time I looked. I get it, I think. Not gold, not flowing, standing still. Then another message appears. "I got your rules for wandering, and I have an addition. We don't travel in bad weather. We walk, jog, or ride bikes. No driving. We don't go far from Bartlett." She is all business now. I reply, "If we're walking, jogging, or riding bikes, that's not going to be a problem." Thinking of her website sitting dead and empty, I add, "We should write about our wanderings, so we have something to show for them besides pictures. Actually, you should do the writing. I'll just smile and look pretty." I am still sitting there an hour later, but she's gone.
Like that, I've either irritated her or scared her away. So I make up song after song. Most nights, these are songs that will change the world, because they are that good and that deep and that damn amazing. But tonight I'm telling myself I don't have anything in common with this violet girl, no matter how much I want to, and asking myself if the words between us were really that hot, or if maybe it was just me imagining, me in overdrive for a girl I barely know, all because she's the first person I've met who seems to speak my language. A few words of it, anyway. I scoop up the sleeping pills and hold them in my palm. I can swallow them right now, lie down on my bed, close my eyes, drift away. But who's going to check on Violet Markey to make sure she's not back up on that ledge? I drop the pills into the toilet and flush them down. And then I go back to eleanorandviolet.com, search the archives till I get to the first post, and move forward through all of them until I've read every single one. I stay up as long as I can, finally falling asleep sometime around 4 a.m. I dream that I'm naked and standing in the bell tower at school, in the cold and the rain. I look below me and everyone is there, teachers and students, and my dad eating a hamburger raw, holding it up to the sky like he's toasting me. I hear a noise over my shoulder and turn to see Violet, on the opposite end of the ledge, and naked too, except for a pair of black boots. It's stupefying, the very best thing I've ever seen with these two eyes. But before I can unhook myself from the stone railing and go to her, she opens her mouth, leaps into the air, and starts to scream. It's the alarm, of course, and I slam it once with my fist before throwing it against the wall, where it lies, bleating like a lost sheep.
Violet. 151 days till graduation. Monday morning, first period. Everyone is talking about the newest post in the Bartlett Dirt, the school gossip rag that not only has its own website, but seems to be taking over the entire internet. Senior hero saves crazy classmate from bell tower jump. We aren't named, but there is a picture of my face. Eyes startled behind Eleanor's glasses, bangs crooked. I look like a makeover before. There's also a picture of Theodore Finch. Jordan Grippenwalt, editor of our school paper, is reading the article to her friends Brittany and Priscilla in a low, disgusted voice. Now and then they glance in my direction and shake their heads, not at me, but at this perfect example of journalism at its worst. These are smart girls who speak their minds. I should be friends with them instead of Amanda. This time last year, I would have spoken up and agreed with them and then written a scathing blog post about high school gossip. Instead, I pick up my bag and tell the teacher I have cramps. I bypass the nurse and climb the stairs to the top floor. I pick the lock to the bell tower. I go only as far as the stairs, where I sit down and, by the light of my phone, read two chapters of Wuthering Heights. I've given up on Anne Bronte and decided there's only Emily. Unruly Emily, angry at the world. If all else perished and he remained, I should still continue to be. And if all else remained and he were annihilated, the universe would turn to a mighty stranger. A mighty stranger, I say to no one. You got that right.
Finch. Day 9. By Monday morning, it's clear that 80s Finch has to go. For one thing, the picture of him in the Bartlett Dirt is not flattering. He looks unnervingly wholesome. I suspect he's a goody-good, what with all the not smoking and vegetarianism and turned up collars. And, for two, he just doesn't feel right to me. He's the kind of guy who's probably great with teachers and pop quizzes and who actually doesn't mind driving his mom Saturn, but I don't trust him not to screw things up with girls. More specifically, I don't trust him to get anywhere with Violet Markey. I meet Charlie at Goodwill during third period. There's one down by the train station, in an area that used to be nothing but abandoned, burned-out factories and graffiti. Now it's been regentrified, which means it got a new coat of paint, and someone decided to pay attention to it. Charlie brings Brenda for fashion backup, even though nothing she wears ever matches, something she swears she does on purpose. While Charlie talks up one of the sales girls, Bren follows me from rack to rack, yawning. She flips half-heartedly through hangers of leather jackets. "What exactly are we looking for?" I say, "I need to be regentrified." She yawns again without covering her mouth, and I can see her fillings. "Late night?" She grins, bright pink lips spreading wide. "Amanda Monk had a party Saturday night. I made out with Gabe Romero." In addition to being Amanda's boyfriend, Romer is the biggest prick in school. For some reason, Bren has had a thing for him since freshman year.
"Will he remember it?"
Her grin fades a little. "He was pretty wasted, but I left one of these in his pocket." She holds up a hand and waves her fingers. One of her blue plastic fingernails is missing. "And, just in case, my nose ring." "I thought you looked different today." "That's just the glow." She's more awake now. She claps her hands together and rubs them all mad scientist-like. "So, what are we looking for?"
"I don't know. Something a little less squeaky clean, maybe a little sexier. I'm done with the 80s.
She frowns. "Is this about what's her name? The skinny chick?" "Violet Markey, and she's not skinny. She has hips."
"And a sweet, sweet ass."
Charlie has joined us now.
"No."
Bren is shaking her head so hard and fast, it looks as if she's having a seizure. "You don't dress to please a girl, especially not a girl like that. You dress to please yourself. If she doesn't like you for you, then you don't need her." All of this would be fine if I knew exactly who me for me was. She goes on, "This is the girl with the blog, the one that actress Gemma Sterling likes? The one who saved her crazy classmate from jumping? Well, screw her and her skinny, skinny ass." Bren hates all girls who aren't at least a size 12. As she rattles on, about Violet, about Gemma Sterling, about the Bartlett dirt, I don't say anything else. I suddenly don't want Bren or Charlie to talk about Violet, because I want to keep her to myself. Like the Christmas I was 8, back when Christmases were still good, and got my first guitar, which I named No Trespassing, as in no one could touch it but me. Finally, though, I have no choice but to interrupt Bren. "She was in that accident last April with her sister. The one where they drove off the A Street Bridge."
"Oh my God. That was her?"
"Her sister was a senior."
"Shit."
Bren cradles her chin in her hand and taps it.
"You know, maybe you should play it a little safer."
Her voice is softer.
"Think Ryan Cross. You see how he dresses. We should go to Old Navy or American Eagle, or, better yet, to Abercrombie over in Dayton."
Charlie says to Brenda, "She's never gonna go for him. Doesn't matter what he wears. No offense, man." "None taken. And fuck Ryan Cross.
I use that word for the first time in my life. It feels so liberating that I suddenly feel like running around the store.
Fuck him.
I decide the new Finch swears whenever and however he wants to. He's the kind of Finch who would stand on a building and think about jumping just because nothing scares him. He is seriously badass.
In that case...
Charlie yanks a jacket off its hanger and holds it up. It's pretty badass, too. All scuffed, worn-out leather, like something Keith Richards might have worn way, way back in the day. It's pretty much the coolest jacket I've ever seen. I'm pulling it on as Bren sighs, walks away, and comes strolling back with a giant pair of black Beatles boots.
They're size 14, she says. But the way you grow, you'll fill them out by Friday.
By lunch, I'm starting to dig badass Finch. For one thing, girls seem to like him. A cute underclassman actually stops me in the hall and asks if I need help finding my way. She must be a freshman because it's clear she has no idea who I am. When she wants to know if I'm from London, I say, "Cheers," and "Eye up," and "Bangers and mash," in what I think is a pretty convincing accent. She alternately giggles and flips her hair as she guides me to the cafeteria. Because BHS has some 2,000 students, they have us divided into three different lunch periods. Brenda skips class today to eat with Charlie and me, and I greet them with the "Cheerio," and "Hello, mates," and "You're the dog's bollocks," and such. Bren just blinks at me, then blinks at Charlie.
"Please tell me he's not British."
He shrugs and keeps eating. I spend the rest of lunch hour talking to them about my favorite spots back home. Honest John's, Rough Trade East, and Out on the Floor, the record shops I hang out in. I tell them about my mean but sexy Irish girlfriend Fiona, and my best blokes Tam and Nats. By the time lunch is through, I've created a universe I can see down to the last detail. The Sex Pistols and Joy Division posters on my wall, the fags I smoke out the window of the flat Fiona and I share, the nights spent playing music at the Hope and Anchor and the Half Moon, the days devoted to cutting records at Abbey Road Studios. When the bell rings and Charlie says, "Let's go, you todger," I feel homesick for this London I left behind.
"Yes, sir."
As I walk through the halls, there's no telling what badass British Finch might do. Take over the school, take over the town, take over the world. It will be a world of compassion, of neighbor loving neighbor, of student loving student, or at least treating one another with respect. No judgments, no name calling, no more, no more, no more. By the time I get to U.S. geography, I've almost convinced myself this world exists. Until I see Ryan Cross, all gold, flowing, his hand on the back of Violet's chair as if he's the host at the Macaroni Grill. He is smiling at her and talking, and she is smiling at him with her mouth closed, gray-green eyes wide and serious behind her glasses. And just like that, I am Indiana-born Theodore Finch in a pair of second-hand boots. Guys like Ryan Cross have a way of reminding you who you are, even when you don't want to remember. As I try to catch Violet's eye, she's too busy nodding and listening to Ryan. And then Romer is there, and Amanda Monk, who fixes me with a death glare and snaps, "What are you looking at?" Then Violet is swallowed by them. So all I can do is stare in the direction of where she once was. Mr. Black wheezes to the front of the room as the bell rings and asks if anyone has questions about the project. Hands go up,
and one by one he addresses the concerns.
Get out there and see your state. Go to museums and parks and historic sites. Get yourselves some culture so that when you do leave, you can take it with you.
In my very best British, I say, But I thought you can't take it with you. Violet laughs. She is the only one. As soon as she does, she turns away from everyone and stares at the wall beside her right shoulder. When the bell rings, I walk past Ryan Cross and Romer and Amanda until I'm standing so close to Violet that I can smell her flower shampoo. The thing about Badass Finch is that guys like Ryan Cross don't intimidate him for long. Amanda says, Can we help you? In her nasally little girl voice. In my regular non-British accent, I say to Violet, It's time to start wandering.
Where?
Her eyes are cold and a little wary, as if she's afraid I might out her right here, right now. Have you been to Hoosier Hill?
No.
It's the highest point in the state.
I've heard.
I thought you might like it, unless you have a fear of heights. I cock my head. Her face goes blank, and then she recovers, the corners of her perfect mouth turning up in a perfect fake smile.
No, I'm okay with them.
She saved you from jumping off that ledge, didn't she?
This is from Amanda. She waves her phone where I can just make out the headline from the Bartlett Dirt. Romer mumbles, Maybe you should go back up there and try again. And miss the opportunity to see Indiana? No thanks. Their eyes bore into me as I look at Violet. Let's go.
Right now?
No time like the present and all that. You of all people should know we're only guaranteed right now. Romer says, Hey, asshole, why don't you ask her boyfriend? I say to Romer, Because I'm not interested in Ryan, I'm interested in Violet. I say to Ryan, It's not a date, man, it's a project.
He's not my boyfriend, Violet says, and Ryan looks so hurt that I almost feel bad for him,
except that it's impossible to feel bad for a guy like him.
I can't skip class.
Why not?
Because I'm not a delinquent.
Her tone is clear, not like you, and I tell myself she's only putting it on for the crowd. I'll wait for you in the parking lot after school. On the way out, I pause.
Come, I say. Come.
It might be my imagination, but she almost smiles.
Freak,
I hear Amanda mutter as I walk out. I accidentally whack my elbow against the doorframe and, for good luck, whack the other.
Violet. 151 days till graduation. 3:30, school parking lot. I stand in the sun, shading my eyes. At first, I don't see him. Maybe he left without me. Or maybe I went out the wrong door. Our town is small, but our school is large. We have over 2,000 students because we're the only high school for miles. He could be anywhere. I am holding on to the handles of my bike, an old orange 10-speed inherited from Eleanor. She named it Leroy because she liked being able to say to our parents, I was out riding Leroy, and I'm just going to ride Leroy for a while. Brenda Shank Kravitz stalks by, a bright pink storm cloud. Charlie Donahue saunters behind. He's over there, Brenda says. She points a blue-nailed finger at me. If you break his heart, I will kick that skinny ass all the way to Kentucky. I mean it. The last thing he needs is you playing with his head. Understood? Understood. And I'm sorry, you know, about your sister. I look in the direction Brenda pointed, and there he is. Theodore Finch leans against an SUV, hands in pockets, like he has all the time in the world, and he expects me. I think of the Virginia Woolf lines, the ones from The Waves, pale with dark hair, the one who is coming is melancholy, romantic, and I am arch and fluent and capricious, for he is melancholy, he is romantic, he is here. I wheel the bike over to him. His dark hair is kind of wild and messy, like he's been at the beach, even though there's no beach in Bartlett, and shines blue-black in the light. His pale skin is so white, I can see the veins in his arms. He opens the passenger door to his car.
After you.
I told you, no driving.
I forgot my bike, so we'll have to go to my house and get it.
Then I'll follow you. He drives slower than he needs to, and 10 minutes later we reach his house. It's a two-story brick colonial, with shrubs crowding under the windows, black shutters, and a red door. There's a matching red mailbox that says Finch. I wait in the driveway while he sorts through the mess of a garage, searching for a bicycle. Finally, he lifts it up and out, and I watch the muscles in his arms flex.
You can leave your bag in my room.
He's wiping the dust off the bike seat with his shirt. But my stuff's in there. A book on the history of Indiana, checked out from the library after last period, and plastic bags of various sizes, courtesy of one of the lunch ladies, for any souvenirs we might collect.
I've got it covered.
He unlocks the door and holds it open for me. Inside, it looks like a regular, ordinary house, not one I'd expect Theodore Finch to live in. I follow him upstairs. The walls are lined with framed school photos. Finch in kindergarten, Finch in middle school. He looks different every year, not just age-wise, but person-wise. Class clown Finch, awkward Finch, cocky Finch, jock Finch. At the end of the hall, he pushes open a door. The walls are a dark, deep red, and everything else is black. Desk, chair, bookcase, bedspread, guitars. One entire wall is covered in pictures and post-it notes and napkins and torn pieces of paper. On the other walls, there are concert posters and a large black-and-white photo of him on stage somewhere, guitar in hand. I stand in front of the wall of notes and say, "What's all this?"
"Plans," he says. "Songs, ideas, visions."
He throws my bag onto his bed and digs something out of a drawer. Most look like fragments of things, single words or phrases that don't make sense on their own. "Night flowers." "I do it so it feels real." "Let us fall." "My decision totally." "Obelisk." "Is today a good day to..." Is today a good day to what, I want to ask. But instead I say, "Obelisk?"
"It's my favorite word."
"Really?"
"One of them, at least." "Look at it."
I look.
"That is one straight-up, upstanding, powerful word. Unique, original, and kind of stealthy because it doesn't really sound like what it is. It's a word that surprises you and makes you think, 'Oh, all right then.' It commands respect, but it's also modest, not like monument or tower."
He shakes his head.
"Pretentious bastards."
I don't say anything because I used to love words. I loved them and was good at arranging them. Because of this, I felt protective of all the best ones. but now all of them, good and bad, frustrate me. He says,
"Have you ever heard the phrase, get back on the camel, before?"
Not until Mr. Black used it. He leans over his desk, tears a piece of paper in half, and writes it down. He slaps it on the wall as we leave. Outside, I climb onto Leroy, resting one foot on the ground. Theodore Finch pulls on a backpack, his t-shirt riding up across his stomach where an ugly red scar cuts across the middle. I push Eleanor's glasses up onto my head. "Where did you get the scar?"
"I drew it on. It's been my experience that girls like scars even better than tattoos."
He straddles the bike, resting back on the seat, both feet firmly planted.
"Have you been in a car since the accident?"
"No."
"That's got to be some sort of record. We're talking, what, 8, 9 months? How do you get to school?"
"I ride my bike, or walk. We don't live that far."
"What about when it rains or snows?"
"I ride my bike or walk."
"So you're afraid to ride in a car, but you'll climb up on a bell tower ledge?"
"I'm going home." He laughs and reaches out for my bike, holding on to it before I can take off.
"I won't bring it up again."
"I don't believe you."
"Look, you're already here, and we're already committed to this project. So, the way I see it, the faster we get to Hoosier Hill, the faster you get this over with."
We pass cornfield after cornfield. Hoosier Hill is only 11 miles from town, so we don't have far to go. The day is cold but bright, and it feels good to be out. I close my eyes and tip my head upward. It's a remnant of the Violet who came before. Normal teenage Violet. Violet unremarkable. Finch rides along beside me.
"You know what I like about driving? The forward motion of it. The propulsion of it. Like, you might go anywhere."
I open my eyes and frown at him. "This isn't driving."
"You're telling me."
He weaves across the road in figure eights, then around me in circles, then rides beside me again.
"I'm surprised you don't wear a helmet or full-on body armor just to be extra safe. What if the apocalypse happened and everyone but you turned into zombies and the only way you could save yourself was to get the hell out of town? No airplanes, no trains, no buses. Public transportation is completely broken down. The bike's too exposed, too dangerous. What then?"
"How do I know I'll be safe out of town?"
"Bartlett's the only place that's been affected."
"And I know this for sure?"
"It's public knowledge. The government has confirmed it."
I don't answer. He figure eights around me.
"Where would you go if you could go anywhere?"
"Is it still the apocalypse?"
"No."
"New York, I think." "Back to California," I say. What I mean is the California of 4 years ago, before we moved here, when Eleanor was a sophomore and I was going into 9th grade.
"But you've already been there. Don't you want to see places you've never been?"
He pedals along, hands in his armpits now. "It's warm there, and it never snows. I hate snow and will always hate snow." And then I hear Mrs. Kresney and my parents telling me to make an effort, so I say, "I might go to Argentina or Singapore for school. I'm not applying any place less than 2,000 miles away. Or any place with an annual snowfall greater than 1 inch, which is why NYU is out. I might stay here, though. I haven't decided."
Don't you want to know where I'd go if I could?
Not really, I think. Where would you go if you could go anywhere? It comes out bitchier than I mean for it to. He leans forward over the handlebars, eyes on me.
I'd go to Hoosier Hill with a beautiful girl.
A grove of trees stands on one side. Flat farmland spreads out on the other, dusted with snow. Finch says,
I think it's down that way.
We leave our bikes by the tree line, and then we cross the road and follow this dirt path only a few yards long. My legs are aching from the ride. I feel strangely breathless. There are some kids hanging out in the field, swaying back and forth on the fence. When they see us coming, one of them bumps another and straightens.
You can go on ahead, he says. People come from all over the world to see it, and you ain't the first.
There used to be a paper sign, one of the other kids adds. She sounds bored. With an Australian accent, Finch tells them,
We're here from Perth. We've come all this way to see the highest peak in Indiana. Is it all right if we scale the summit?
They don't ask where Perth is. They just shrug. We turn off into the grove of brown winter trees, brushing branches out of our faces. We duck onto a narrower dirt path and keep going, no longer side by side. Finch is in front, and I pay more attention to the shine of his hair and the way he ambles, loose-jointed and fluid, than I do to the scenery. Suddenly we're there, in the middle of a brown circle. A wooden bench sits underneath a tree, a picnic table just past it. The sign is to our right. Indiana High Point, Hoosier Hill. Elevation 1,257 feet. The marker is straight ahead. A wooden stake poking up out of the ground in the middle of a pile of stones, no wider or higher than a pitcher's mound.
This is it? I can't help saying. Some high point.
It's amazingly underwhelming. But then what did I expect? He takes my hand and pulls me up after him so that we're standing on the stones. In that instant his skin touches mine, I feel a little shock. I tell myself it's nothing more than the understandable jolt of actual physical contact when you aren't used to it from someone new. But then, these electric currents start shooting up my arm, and he's rubbing my palm with his thumb, which makes the currents go shooting through the rest of me.
Uh-oh.
In the Australian accent, he says,
What do we think?
His hand is firm and warm, and somehow big as it is, it fits with mine. If we're here from Perth? I'm distracted by the electric currents and trying not to show it. If I do, I know he will never let me hear the end of it.
Or maybe we've come from Moscow.
He has a good Russian accent, too. We are seriously pissed. In his own voice, he says,
Not as pissed as the folks over at Sand Hill, the second highest spot in Indiana. It's only 1,076 feet, and they don't even have a picnic area.
If they're second, they don't really need one.
An excellent point. As far as I'm concerned, it's not even worth looking at. Not when you've got Hoosier Hill.
He smiles at me. And for the first time I notice how blue his eyes are, like bright sky blue.
At least, it feels that way, standing here with you.
He closes his blue eyes and breathes in. When he opens them again, he says,
Actually, standing next to you makes it feel as high as Everest.
I yank my hand back. Even after I let go, I feel the stupid current. Shouldn't we be collecting things, writing stuff down, shooting video? How do we organize this?
We don't. when we're in the act of wandering, we need to be present, not watching it through a lens. Together we look out over the circle of brown and the bench and the trees and the flat white landscape beyond. 10 months ago, I would have stood here writing this place in my head. There is this sign, which is a good thing, because otherwise you would never know you're looking at the highest point in Indiana. I would have thought up an entire backstory for the kids, something epic and exciting. Now they're just Indiana farm kids hanging on a fence. I say, I think this is the ugliest place I've ever seen. Not just here, the whole state. I hear my parents telling me not to be negative, which is funny because I've always been the happy one. It's Eleanor who was moody.
I used to think that, but then I realized, believe it or not, it's actually beautiful to some people. It must be, because enough people live here, and they can't all think it's ugly.
He smiles out at the ugly trees and the ugly farmland and the ugly kids as if he can see Oz, as if he can really truly see the beauty that's there. In that moment, I wish I could see it through his eyes. I wish he had glasses to give me.
Also, I figure while I'm here, I might as well get to know it, you know, see what there is to see.
Wander Indiana?
Yeah.
You look different than you did the other day. He glances at me sideways, eyes half closed.
It's the altitude.
I laugh, and then stop myself.
It's okay to laugh, you know. The earth's not going to split open. You're not going to hell. Believe me, if there's a hell, I'll be there ahead of you, and they'll be too busy with me to even check you in.
I want to ask what happened to him. Is it true he had a breakdown? Is it true he OD'd? Where was he at the end of last semester? I've heard a lot of stories.
About me?
Are they true?
Probably.
He shakes the hair out of his eyes and stares at me good and hard. His gaze trails slowly down my face to my mouth. For a second, I think he's going to kiss me. For a second, I want him to. So we can cross this one off, right? One down, one to go. Where to next? I sound like my dad's secretary.
I've got a map in my backpack.
He doesn't make a move to get it. Instead, he stands there, breathing it in, looking all around. I want to get to the map because that's how I am, or used to be. Ready for the next thing once I've got it in my mind. But he's not going anywhere. And then his hand finds mine again. Instead of snatching it back, I make myself stand here too. And actually, it's nice. The electric currents are racing. My body is humming. The breeze is blowing, rustling the leaves on the trees. It's almost like music. We stand side by side, looking out and up and around.
And then he says, "Let's jump."
Are you sure? It is the high point of Indiana.
I'm sure. It's now or never. But I need to know if you're with me.
Okay.
Ready?
Ready.
On three.
We jump just as the kids ramble up. We land dusty and laughing. In the Australian accent, Finch says to them,
"We are professionals. Whatever you do, don't try this at home."
The things we leave behind are some British coins, a red guitar pick, and a Bartlett High keychain. We store them in this hide-a-key fake rock that Finch found in his garage. He wedges it in among the stones that surround the high point.
He brushes the dirt off his hands as he stands.
Whether you want to or not, now we'll always be a part of here. Unless those kids get in there and rob us blind.